information. We tried to go to the record, and we couldn't determine how that was served and processed, but we'll get to them in a minute.
Sure, Your Honor. I thought that it was included within
the appendix. Parties have argued the case on the basis that the statutes say the same thing. They don't.
The
result might be the same, but these services occurred, then maybe they don't say the same thing.
Well, in this instance, I think it's a distinction without a difference because the...
Well, it might be factually in this case, but it may not be legally for purposes of an opinion.
Well, in this instance, the original third-party complaint and the amended complaint were both served. The first amended complaint served without a certificate of merit. It's actually a little confusing because the attorney for PCS then filed another third-party complaint, but forgot to call it an amended third-party complaint. So that was served without, that was also
served. Could we clarify a couple of things?
Sure.
And I'd like other counsel to. Do you agree with me that 11258.1 and 3 says, shall file an affidavit with the court concurrently with the service of the first pleading?
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
Okay. So do you agree that the duty to provide the affidavit is connected to the date of service?
I believe, Your Honor, that's a reasonable interpretation. And in this instance, no certificate of merit was served with the third-party complaint.
Well, the interesting question about the language we've just discussed is this. You file an affidavit with the court concurrently with service of the first pleading. Now, that says to me that you file the affidavit with the court. You don't necessarily serve it on the defendant. Would seem to defeat the point of having it, but that's what the language seems to say.
I think it has to be filed and served. That's the only plausible, reasonable explanation. Otherwise, there could be certificates of merit on file, and the litigants receiving them have no idea they exist.
Yeah, well, let's assume that premise for the moment. Then, as to the third-party complaint filed by PCS, what, in your view, does the record show as to what was or was not attached at a time of service of the third-party complaint and the, I characterize it, fugitive third-party complaint?
Well, I'd have to review each document in the appendix, Your Honor, but the third, I think it's undisputed in this instance, and no one has raised this issue in any of the pleadings, that the third-party complaint was filed and served without a certificate of merit. I don't think anyone in this case disputes that.
Okay, and you believe the record also is uncontested that the amended third-party complaint was not approved by the court?
Yes, Your Honor. It was brought without leave of court and in violation of the court's scheduling order, which had cut off dates for amendments and to bring in new parties.
Okay, because, and in any event, that too was served without the required affidavit.
The amended third-party complaint attached a certificate of merit, albeit one that did not meet the criteria set forth in 11258.
Okay. Then as to Pacific Cap, what was served there?
Pacific Cap sought leave to amend to name OTAC, but filed no certificate of merit whatsoever, served no certificate of merit, and their position in our motion to dismiss that cross-claim was that they were entitled to simply piggyback ride on the certificate of merit filed by PCS.
Which the judge permitted, apparently, in the order granting the amendment.
The judge did permit it. The judge did not believe that fairly applied to this case because it involved doctors and not design professionals, but he was unable to articulate a sound, rational basis distinguishing between the two.
But in any event, It's at least from your point of view, it's undisputed that Pacific Cap did not attach any certificate to anything they served.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Sorry for the interruption, but I, after reviewing the briefs and the statutes, seem to be a disconnect in what's going on here.
Hopefully that clears it up. So applying the rule of Fierli that a complaint filed without a certificate of merit is void ab initio, OTAC sought to dismiss the third-party complaint and the amended third-party complaint of PCS as well as its defective certificate of merit. OTAC also sought to dismiss the cross-claim by PNR, which similarly lacked a certificate of merit. And again, Respondent Court, while acknowledging that the statutes are parallel, was unable to articulate a reason why the rule should not be applied equally to both parties, other than one was one sort of professional and OTAC was another. Unfortunately, Respondent Court ruled consistent with how other district courts have ruled and excused the many procedural and technical defects in the pleadings, in the complaint, in the fugitive amended complaint, and the defective certificate of merit. Honestly, there has been judicial hostility towards the enforcement of 11258 since it was enacted in October of 2007. Fortunately, this case presents these matters a first impression, and again, I thank you for deeming them important enough to accept the writ petition for review. So why are certificate of merit so important, and why should this court apply the ruling fairly to an architect? As a threshold matter, states that have enacted certificate of merit statutes, those statutes generally apply to doctors, lawyers, and design professionals. All such professionals can only be found liable upon a finding that they breached their applicable standard of care. Such a finding must be based on competent testimony from qualified experts who are like-kind in the discipline of the design professional being charged. The legislative objective behind all such statutes is virtually identical. It's to ferret out frivolous suits and shotgun pleadings, which clog the courts and ultimately drive scarce and valued professionals out of business and out of the state. The Certificate of Merit statutes do not impose an undue burden on claimants. Rather, they simply force a claimant to do their homework at the beginning of a case instead of 3 or 4 or 5 years later when the case is on the brink of trial. So they must secure that qualified opinion before the case may move forward. This court, in the Bork decision in 2004, stated it best when citing the underlying purpose of the medical malpractice certificate of merit, quote, to ensure that such actions be brought in good faith based upon competent expert opinion. In this, the statute clearly works against frivolous lawsuits filed with some vague hope that a favorable expert opinion might eventually surface. This same objective is espoused in the legislative history of NRS 11258, which expressly draws a parallel to Nevada's Certificate of Merit statute for medical professionals. The discussions during the committee meetings of May 14, 2007 are particularly apt in outlining the legislative intent, which is nearly identical to the legislative intent behind the Medical Certificate of Merit statute. Your honors are all well familiar with Fierli. I note that all three of you concurred with the majority opinion drafted by Justice Cherry. Further, Justice Hardesty, you drafted the opinion in Washoe Medical Center, which served as the basis, underlying basis, for the Fierli decision. Thus, you have all educated us on the importance and the public policy behind the Certificate of Merit statutes and the requirement that they be vigorously enforced. As stated in the Washoe Medical Center case, quote, although the statute may have harsh results in some cases, it cuts with a sharp but clean edge, end quote. That is precisely what OTAC is asking this court to do. OTAC requests that this court apply the sound reasoning in Fierli and hold PCS's complaint as being void ab initio and thus not curable by amendment. To hold otherwise would deprive OTAC of equal protection under the law required by the 14th Amendment, the United States Constitution, as well as Article 4 of the Nevada Constitution, which requires all laws be general and uniform of operation throughout the state. Thus, pursuant to this statute, this court also, in the State Farm versus All Electric case, struck down a statute of repose that favored architects as being unconstitutional and violative of equal protection under the law. Here, there is simply no rational basis to hold that the Fieri decision does not apply to OTEC, and respondent district court could not articulate one. PCS's citation to Allstate versus Ferguson is unavailing because this court articulated in that case a valid rational basis why equal protection was not violated by that statute because of an existing body of law that governed material suppliers and manufacturers. OTAC is entitled to equal protection under the law, and I believe this court did intend that Fieri would apply to them. Briefly addressing the latter two issues, is a certificate of merit, when supported by an expert report, valid when it fails to comply with the specific directives, including failing to include relevant documentation? That means I have how much time?
It means that you are actually out of time, but I'm going to give you two more minutes on your first presentation, and I'll give you a minute on rebuttal because we spend a great deal of time going through the record with you. So I'll give you an additional 2 minutes now, and on rebuttal a little bit more time.
Perfect. Thank you, Your Honor. Is a certificate of merit, when supported by an expert report that doesn't meet the elements of 11258, is it valid when it fails to include the relevant documentation that the expert relied upon, fails to set forth the relevant basis for the expert's opinion of negligence, and fails to opine that there's a reasonable basis for the filing of the action? NRS 258 is essentially a roadmap as to how to comply with the statute. It's a lengthy statute in comparison to other certificate of merit statutes. It states an attorney for the complainant shall file the affidavit. It must be attached. It must, among other things, include relevant documents, and there must be a conclusion that there's reasonable basis for the filing of the action. In this regard, PCS's certificate of merit was woefully lacking in both form and substance. The statute is specific. It is does
well,
not.
Well, let's question that a moment or test that. What in 11-258-3 permits the district court to weigh the sufficiency of the expert's report, so long as the report contains each of the prescribed items in the statute?
I don't think anything in the statute gives the court discretion to waive or
weigh.
To weigh. Your Honor, I think that the statute has the elements that must be met, and it's
and how did the report in this case? How did the report in this case fail to meet the prescribed items to be listed? In what way did it fail to meet that?
It did not identify the universe of documents relevant to reaching an opinion on the standard of care. It had three illegible blackened photographs, a contract of OTAC, and a site plan. That documentation simply cannot be sufficient for an expert making the very serious conclusion that an architect fell below the standard of care. Those three or four pages of documents compared to a job file, which was probably 10,000 pages long, simply is insufficient to be able to draw a conclusion that an architect committed malpractice.
But isn't your argument requesting the court to weigh the basis for the expert's report? I mean, you may be correct in your argument that what the expert listed appears insufficient to arrive at the conclusion, but all the statute requires is that they list what they relied upon.
Well, it requires.
So I'm trying to determine whether you're arguing about compliance with what's to be listed or weighing what has been listed.
there's two prongs to that answer, Your Honor. One is I think there is some evaluation that must be conducted by the district court to determine if it meets the elements. But in this instance, there was one aspect of the certificate that was completely missing and absent, and that was an affidavit whereby the expert attests that there is a reasonable basis for filing of the action. That was simply missing from the affidavit, and the statute requires that. So while there may be an evaluative process that a district court may undertake in determining whether other elements have been satisfactorily met, in that instance where it's missing, I think there's no discretion.
How does the judge reconcile that? Obviously, you brought that up at the time this was
He didn't
heard.
Want to hear it. He didn't want to hear from us. He cut us off. He was not interested in this argument. He basically decided from the onset that because Fierli dealt with doctors, in this case was architects, we were wasting the court's time.
But I mean challenging the elements, he made no ruling or he didn't address that at all?
He did not. I believe we've attached a copy of the oral argument, and it was extremely brief, and we were pretty much cut off at the knees and not permitted to complete our argument. But our papers outlined all of these points and positions. I think that...
So you're arguing that the affidavit in this case was defective under the statute because subsection 5 was not satisfied.
Yes, Your Honor, and I do not believe that the other requirements were met in good faith in terms of the documentation reviewed, and the expert's opinion was not a reasoned opinion explaining at all how the opinion related to the documents or anything that would provide the architect with some type of causal connection or understanding of what claims are being asserted against him. And again, the statute specific, it does not read like a game of horseshoes where close enough is good enough. The statute's designed to ferret out frivolous claims by requiring a heightened level of diligence on both the part of the attorney and on the part of the expert. What happens in the real world, as Your Honors probably all know, is that before certificates of merit are issued, whether it's involving a doctor, a lawyer, a design professional, there's usually a subpoena served upon the office of a design professional where the totality of their job file is produced so that an expert can actually read through the whole file and have the universe of documents and the totality of the circumstances in order to evaluate whether the design professional met the standard of care.
Ms. Well, I'm going to have to cap your argument at this point. I will give you a minute 30 on rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Counsel. And please rest assured, should you need additional time, I'll give you a few minutes as well.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Tom Friedman. I represent Pacific Cap Construction Services in this matter. Mr. Brown is here also representing the Pacific Cap ownership entities. He'll have some comments after I'm through.
How do you intend to divide your time, counsel?
50-50, if that would please the court.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Medical malpractice case of Fierli should not be applied to construction design matters for a number of reasons. Obviously, the work of a design professional is very different than the work of a medical professional. More importantly, the statutes that govern the different professions were drafted for different purposes and contain different languages.
Counsel, they still require a showing that if you're going to proceed against a professional, there's a standard of care that would have to have been violated, and I think that was the purpose for this statutory enactment. Would you comment on that?
Yes, Your Honor. The complaint was admittedly filed, third-party complaint, without a certificate of merit attached to it. The next complaint was filed with a certificate of merit attached to it, and I believe the crux of the argument here today is that Fierli says it was void ab initio.
Why are the policies so different? What do you see as a distinction in the policy with medical professionals as opposed to any other profession that has a statute requiring that a certificate of some type be filed?
I think the main difference is that the architect statute, NRS 11.258, allows a pleading to be filed without a certificate of merit and then allows it to be cured at a later time. and the medical malpractice statute does not allow that. 11258 Section 2 states the attorney for the complainant may file the affidavit required pursuant to subsection 1 at a later time if the attorney could not consult with the expert and prepare the affidavit before filing the action without causing the action to be impaired or barred by statute of limitations. So arguably, if a complaint was filed without a certificate of merit and fairly applied, that complaint would be invalid. It would be void. Therefore, it would be...
Well, thus you all, that's why I raised the question. Doesn't the statute at issue in this case connect this to service, not filing? The language says you got to file it at the time of service, doesn't it?
Yes. I believe Your Honor's questioning earlier was related to the actual date the pleading was served on the parties.
Well, the statute at issue in this case, there is a difference between the medical malpractice statute and the statute here. The requirement to file an expert affidavit or report or certification, however it's characterized, under the medical malpractice statute is at the time the complaint is filed. This statute says you got to file it by the time you serve it. So isn't subsection 2 compatible with the concept that if you can't file it at the time of the filing of the complaint, you have some additional time to get it filed before you serve the complaint?
I understand the concept. In this particular case, it is my understanding that the amended complaint was actually filed after service had already been made on OTAC of the first complaint.
Which makes it important in this case to determine whether or not the third amended complaint was a fugitive complaint. Was it filed without a leave of court?
Well, the original third-party complaint was filed with leave of court. That was not an issue before today, unfortunately.
So the amended third-party complaint. Counsel has represented to this court that the amended third-party complaint, which did attach the certificate, was filed without leave of court. Do you concede that?
I concede there was not a written request for leave to amend, Your Honor. I do believe the court accepted the third-party complaint.
I mean, this is why service is important. If I were to file a complaint, I would be able to amend that complaint without leave of court at least once at any time up until the time for service is required date. Now, in this case, the question is, was the third-party complaint, did you have to have leave of court to amend the third-party complaint after you served it?
Arguably, Rule 15 allows for an amendment before the opposing party has responded. In this case, OTAC did not respond until after the amended complaint had already been filed and served.
Okay. So the language in this statute about when you have to file the certificate being connected to service is pretty important, wouldn't you agree?
I would agree, Your Honor.
And yes. Could become a major distinction between this and a malpractice claim.
I agree, Your Honor.
So what's your argument on that point? I'm not trying to talk you into this. I'm just trying to get some guidance from counsel here.
This is an issue I was not prepared to argue today. I would appreciate the opportunity to brief it, but to my best recollection, there was originally leave by the court to file this complaint. Leave was granted. The complaint was filed and served. The amended complaint was filed, I believe, without a written motion, and the court allowed it. And
is there an order that allowed the filing of a amended third-party complaint?
You're just saying that the court accepted it.
Correct. I do not know whether the court verbally allowed it to go forward during the minutes. I have not reviewed that.
In other words, someone went to the clerk's office or pushed a button on a computer and filed it.
That's possible, Your Honor. I do not know. I am prepared to speak a little bit more about Fearly, but I do not have any more information on this important issue.
Okay.
As I discussed earlier, the NRS 11258 allows for a filing of a complaint without a certificate of merit and allows for that to be cured. In this case here, the curing should allow for this to go forward because Fearly has no opportunities whatsoever for a medical malpractice claim to be cured. As we discussed before, NRCP Rule 15 allows for amendment at least one time before the responding party has filed a response, which did not happen here. And I would like to pass to other counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Mark Brown. I'm with Lewis Brisbois, and I'm here on behalf of Pacific Cap Properties Group, Pacific Cap Holdings, Cheyenne Apartments, Jason Reniker, and Chad Reniker. I'll refer to them as PNR. It's done in the briefs. I think it makes it simpler. the specific issue that PNR wishes to address was the issue regarding whether a party may serve a cross-claim for implied indemnity, contribution, apportionment, if there's already properly in place a certificate of merit filed by another party. I would direct the court's attention to a recent case out of Texas that was issued last month. It's the CTL/Thompson Texas LLC case. It's at 2011 Texas Appeals, Lexus 1580. The court in that case held that there wasn't a need to have a party that was simply filing, in effect, derivative claims to have a need to have a certificate of merit. The reason for that is that the purpose of the statute, the certificate of merit statute, in this case, the Texas statute, section 150.002 of the Texas Civil Procedure and Remedies Code, had a purpose similar to ours in that it was seeking to protect against frivolous lawsuits. And once a proper certificate of merit was in place, then another party that was seeking to have a fair allocation among the parties involved should be allowed to do so.
Well, assuming that the panel agreed with your argument, then your case rises or falls on the validity of the certificate of merit filed or not filed by PCS.
It absolutely does.
Okay.
It also draw the court's attention to a distinction in a case, another 2011 case that just came out. It's a Harris Construction case. It's a 2011 case out of Texas, 2011 U.S. District, Lexus 3232. And in that case, the court said that where there was an indemnity contribution provision, there would be a need for a certificate of merit.
Is there a statutory scheme similar to the one that sets forth the requirements for the certificate of merit as we have here in the state of Nevada?
It's fairly close. It's not exactly on point. There's a major distinction in one line that says that a complaint may be dismissed with prejudice. The court has some discretion on that. But the framework is overall very similar to ours and quite different from the Pennsylvania statute that was referred to by OTEC in its brief, which covered all professionals, doctors, lawyers, lumped them all together, clients and patients is the reference. The reason I point out the Harris Construction case is to make a distinction for the court. In the Harris Construction case, the homeowner sued the developer. The developer then filed its claims against a number of parties, including the architect. And when they filed against that architect, they put in various claims for indemnity and so forth, contribution against that architect. Now, the relevance of that is that they were the first ones going after suing the architect, so they were required to have a certificate of merit. So I'm drawing the distinction that it's critical to whether a certificate of merit should be required of other parties as to whether one is already in place. And all that the party seeking, who's now filed another cross-claim against a party already in the case with a certificate of merit against them, is that if they're already in the case properly through a certificate of merit, they should not have to have another architect go out and get a certificate of merit. Now, OTAC relied on a case, Walsh, which is really inapplicable to our situation. In Walsh, parties were a bunch of partners in a law firm. They were cross-claiming against each other. So they were actually needed certificate of merits, even though they're designated as cross-claims, because each one was taking an opposing position in that case. And in fact, if you look at the Pennsylvania case of Schillis American Acquisition Corp., I think that's a Pennsylvania case cited in the Walsh case relied upon by OTAC. That actually shows the distinction I'm making. That's at 2006 U.S. District Lexus 72090. It's out of Middle District of Pennsylvania, where the Pennsylvania court declined to require a court to require a certificate of merit for a plaintiff who was intervening because one was already in place. So the basic position of PNR is that if a certificate of merit is properly in place, the court shouldn't require everyone to do so. To require that would create an enormous problem. In a case like the one we have, theoretically, the multi-parties, we would have to go out and have 6 to 10 architectural experts all bring certificate of merits once an architect was already in the case. It's actually overly burdensome, and it actually goes against what the basic purpose of that statute was. With the remaining
counsel, since your case rests on Mr. McCullen's certificate or affidavit, could you address counsel's argument that the affidavit fails to satisfy the requirements of 11258 subparagraph 5?
I would say that the language of the statute is what it is. If someone submits that affidavit and has those elements, the idea of getting into arguments at the stage of the certificate of merit over the merits of everything to do with the case and how many documents you're going to have and what's required in order to support it.
Well, that wasn't my question.
Then I'm sorry, I'm missing that subsection. What is?
Okay. The subsection at issue, I recognize counsel argued that the court should weigh the sufficiency of the affidavit. But my question is much more narrow than that.
All right.
11258 subparagraph 5 says that the affidavit must also state, I'll get it for you here in just a second, that the, in addition to making the opinion about failure to satisfy the standard of care, that it must also include a statement that the filing of the action is appropriate. And again, I'm trying to find the specific language here. An opinion from the expert, quote, that there is a reasonable basis for filing the action, close quote. Does Mr. McCullen's certificate satisfy that requirement?
I can't tell you whether it had that specific statement in it, Your Honor. I don't have it right in front of me whether it...
It doesn't contain that statement. The question is whether the court should treat what it does say as sufficient to meet that section.
I believe so, because I believe that the certificate clearly does say that Mr. McCullen was offering the opinion that OTEC had fallen below the standard of care. And that is the whole purpose of this statute. If I may comment
briefly
on the issue regarding this distinction between doctors and other professionals, there's extensive argument saying that, you know, perhaps they shouldn't. Nevada has recognized by having two very differently worded statutes that they are treated differently. And I think that the essential issue is that doctors have to deal with patients, and often there are negative results, bad results. And because of that, that can lead to a lot of frivolous lawsuits. Architects, lawyers, others don't deal with patients. They deal with clients. And their situation is, the doctor's situation is uniquely different from those who have to deal with clients. There isn't going to be, and always will be, a large number of unfortunate results. And that's what you have when you're dealing with doctors.
Why would there ever be a requirement for a certificate of merit then? What's the policy and the reason behind that? It's not similar.
It's not that the policy behind it for both of them may be a similar policy to prevent frivolous lawsuits, but the distinction in the application of those statutes it reflects also the wording of the statutes. You may have distinctions in the application. You want to avoid frivolous lawsuits, but you may address a doctor's patient situation with what doctors have to face and their insurance situation or anything differently from the certificate of merit and the way the requirements are for it in the context of other professionals, because they simply don't have the same burdens that the doctors have. So I'm suggesting that the reason these statutes were worded differently and the reason the court might consider being more flexible in the context of a certificate of merit and construction defect than opposed to a certificate of merit for doctors is that we're dealing with two very different situations.
Well, it's an interesting argument from a public policy standpoint, but hasn't the legislature made that decision? We shouldn't be making public policy decisions like that. They said architects get this the benefit of this protection. Where in the statute does the court have the flexibility to disregard the filing of a certificate as prescribed in the statute?
And I would have to agree with the court that the certificate of merit is required. I would just say that the language of those two are different, and that if the court interprets the certificate applicable, the requirements of statute applicable here, that the court could look at the language of it and interpret the flexibility that's actually built into that statute for later filing. And I would note for the court.
But counsel, the same exact purpose, at least as I think we read the statute, is set forth in the two certificate or affidavit as in the Med-Mal situation requirements. And that is, if you are going to allege negligence against an expert wherein the determination will be made whether or not he or she deviated from an accepted standard of care, that's the purpose here, is that we mere mortals can't make those determinations, and we require an expert to tell us, at the very least to some reasonable degree, I don't want to go to the medical malpractice statute, but with some certainty that there is a valid basis for this complaint being filed. Whether it's doctor-patient or design professional-client, still the same, right?
And factually specific to this case, what we had, the situation we had that we were dealing with, is we had a CMO. And the issue of the scheduling order and filing these amended complaints, none of that actually applied. The actual practice of all the parties under the CMO was and has continued to be under the CMO that we currently have placed in our case, was that all the parties, as discovery came in, were rushing to file amended pleadings. That's what we did throughout this
case. CMO can get around statutory requirement for filing of a certificate of merit?
No, the issue would be, if you're looking at this statute, the fact that these things, there's no attempt here, I'm not making the argument, you can get around a certificate of merit. Absolutely, you need to have a certificate of merit. The position that was presented today was that should the certificate of merit be allowed to be filed, even though it was in this late amended pleading, in the case that we had, that we were dealing with, a amended pleadings were being routinely allowed for all the parties as discovery work was coming in on the case because we were rushed to do discovery in a very short time in under the needs of the case. And so what I'm suggesting is that if this statute, unlike the certificate of merit requirement for the doctors, which simply says in one line, it shall be dismissed, here the wording of this statute does appear to be more flexible on the timing for the filing and the submission of the certificate of merit.
Now, how do you reconcile that?
If it's not, then I would ask the court, if it's not, I would ask that the court give a ruling that simply says that the parties are free, that if it's dismissed, it's dismissed without prejudice and allows the parties the opportunity to refile third-party complaints with proper certificate of merits, because there's no statute of limitations issue here for the parties involved. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, I'm glad you finished your thought. I just, you make an interesting argument, as does your colleague, but it seems to fly in the face of the language in 11-259-1B that says that if the expert report is not filed, the district court, quote, shall dismiss the action, close quote. By giving some open-ended opportunity to obtain a certificate at some point in the course of the litigation seems to fly in the face of that language, wouldn't you agree?
I'd have to agree with Your Honor that when I looked at the language, the definitional terms of where it says what is a non-residential construction, it's defining the action to be upon the moment that a complaint is filed against one of a professional. That's the definitional language. So I would have to agree with you. I'm not trying to say that the statute doesn't say what it says. Yeah. It does say that there would be the matter would be dismissed if there isn't the certificate of merit. I guess all I'm suggesting is that the language, the other language, it's a fairly lengthy statute, appears to provide circumstances, situations where the certificate of merit wouldn't be filed, wouldn't be served right when the complaint is, right at the time of the complaint. There are built into it some exceptions, and I think we had a fairly unique situation in our case.
Well, Fairley says that in the medical malpractice context, the complaint gets dismissed because it's void ab initio. Fairley does not say with or without prejudice. Statute of limitations consequence isn't addressed.
I'm asking the court to address the issue. We don't have any, the statute.
I mean, it might be in a construction defect case because of the length of the statute of limitations or period of repose or whatever, that you have another opportunity to refile.
I see. So, Your Honor, if I'm following this, is that if an order said it's simply dismissed, then the issue would still go back to whether the statute of limitations had passed or not.
That's a separate question.
Separate question. And this particular statute doesn't say it has to be dismissed with prejudice. It doesn't say anything about dismissing
with prejudice. Well, neither does the medical malpractice statute.
Right. So in that case, it's also, so in Fairley, the dismissal might act to be a dismissal with prejudice, but it might not. And the same is true here.
Right.
And that's all that we would hope for.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Other questions, colleagues? Ms. Webb.
Yeah, Your Honor, thank you.
A real minute and 30 this time.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Friedman and Mr. Brown may be confused about the procedural history, Your Honor, but I am not. And let me clear it up so there's no question. There was a scheduling order of October 2nd, 2008, that set the deadline for seeking leave to add new parties and new claims for January 15th, 2009. 8 months later, counsel for PCS sought leave of court to file a third-party complaint to name OTAC, and that leave was granted. However, no leave was sought, either orally or by virtue of motion, to file the amended third-party complaint. So there is absolutely nothing in the record to suggest that counsel got a wink and a nod from the district court or an okay verbally. There's absolutely nothing in the record to support that that amended complaint was properly filed with leave of court. In fact, it was not. There was no leave of court, and it was in direct violation of the scheduling order. So that second bite rule where a party gets leave to amend again without leave of court simply doesn't apply here, because the scheduling order, which is identified in OTAC's appendix as page 212, expressly states that deadline. So therefore, the complaint is a fugitive document and not entitled to be considered, and it lacked the certificate of merit. Very quickly, the question is, why should a certificate of merit, why is one certificate of merit good enough for all? And essentially, the statute at hand does not say that only the first complainant and only the first expert must file a certificate of merit. It says the complainant must file a certificate of merit. And that makes complete sense, because there could be different theories of liability against a design professional, different measures of damages based upon different parties seeking to sue them. So there's absolutely nothing in 11258 which allows a party to piggyback ride on a certificate of merit filed by another. If the statute intended that, it would have said so.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Weil. Thank you to all parties for your presentations here this morning. We are going to move directly into the 10:30 argument.